have higher rates of dying from COVID-19, the vaccine can actually save our lives. Not only save your life, but save the life of your family members. And so when people have a hesitation around taking the vaccine, again, you should consider, what are the benefits of me taking the vaccine versus the risk of me getting or having long-term effects of actually getting COVID? And once you consider that, once you've talked with your doctor, then make a decision of whether or not it's okay to do it now.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB, Stony Brook. It's 6 o'clock time for Off the Wall. Good evening to all of you. It's Emmanuel Goldstein here on this Tuesday evening for another edition of Off the Wall, joined tonight by Kyle. I'm sorry, I didn't have your button on. Try that again.
Hello.
Well, we are going to talk about the disaster that's going on in Afghanistan. Yes, it is a disaster. No question about that. But first, some late-breaking news. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has succeeded in his bid to get COVID-19, despite being vaccinated.
He got it. Success.
He tried so hard, encouraging people not to get vaccines, encouraging people to walk around without masks, encouraging people to not spread information, because information has a virus, on if a school is infected, has positive cases. No need to spread that around. And now he's spreading COVID around. And the thing is, he was at a large gathering, fairly large gathering, of people, many of whom were not masked in the past couple of days. So this is actually yesterday. Yesterday at a GOP event in Collin County, talking to a maskless crowd. And you have to wonder, you know, everything that we have learned about this disease indicates that, yes, you can be vaccinated, but you could have a breakthrough case and even less of a chance of getting sick. He's probably going to be fine because he got vaccinated. But what you can do is transmit the virus. And the receiver of that transmission is not going to differentiate between people who are vaccinated and people who are not vaccinated. It's the virus. They're going to get the virus, and if they're not vaccinated, then they have a much, much greater risk of becoming seriously ill. So what the governor has done is basically ensure that as many people as possible have gotten sick through him directly. And I guess this is some kind of an honor, because to get infected by the governor himself is probably something a lot of those people in the crowd would be proud of. I don't mean to be facetious here. Oh God, I sound like Biden, don't I? Look, it's insane what we are watching. The irresponsibility of some of these elected officials in Florida, in Texas, in Louisiana, which happen to be the three states that are leading the numbers now. Think that's a coincidence? So, you know, I hope that we're starting to get really impatient with this idiocy and that we start to do something about it. Look how quickly people acted against Cuomo when it became apparent that he was unfit to continue serving. Why can't we see the same outrage toward those people who are actually going about hurting people through their idiocy? There is no longer any debate on this. You know, if you insist on debating it, then you're pretty much making up facts and living in a fantasy world where somehow the things that are happening right in front of you aren't real. So, yeah, Governor Abbott has COVID, and I'm sure DeSantis is not far behind. I feel bad for all the people that are going to be hospitalized, that will lose other people as a result, a direct result. And I feel bad that they'll probably get away with it. You know, they'll probably get away with it because of science denial and people who will stand up for their candidate no matter what. It's sickening. Quite literally sickening. Any thoughts on this, Kyle, before we move on to the big elephant in the room?
It's unfortunate that he got sick, and I'm saddened to hear some of the horrific stories of people in total, complete denial, and the healthcare workers that are having to care for them in a moment of physical and mental breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so unfortunate. I also accept that these are adults making adult decisions, and many of them have been quite righteous about those decisions.
But are they adult decisions? I mean,
making adults.
They're adults making decisions, but are they making? Why am I saying adult? That's not how I pronounce the word adult. Making adult decisions.
Wow. It's not about pronunciation.
Well, yeah, I just had to think about that for a second. So they're not making adult decisions. They're adults making decisions, but they are making completely uninformed.
Poor decisions.
Yes, poor decisions. It's not just because I disagree. It's because they are not weighing facts. They're disregarding facts. They're making up facts.
And at a certain point, when you're hostile to people that plead with you, even family members, or if you're a representative, you know, in leadership, maybe superintendents of schools or health institutions in your area, individual citizens, whatever it is, if you are being pled to by these, you just ignore the pleadings of so many individuals who have expertise, who have experience, who have knowledge on the ground in your district or domain. And you still make poor decisions in light of all the evidence and all of the pleadings and good information and good intentions. I there's just no more room after a certain point. People, especially if you're deriding them and attacking them and flouting any kind of guidance and dismissing and as I said, in total denial, people will stop. They'll stop pleading with you. Many people are not. You know, many people want to get the message out and are trying to fill the void where leadership is not. But I understand where some individuals will just choose this over the option of survival. And that's it's a wild sort of letting go, I think. And there are other people that will listen, that can be reached, and I think that's the important part, especially with so much going on in schools. That's important. Kids. There's higher rates of kids getting sick now.
And there will be much more as the variant spreads, as kids go back to school, because this variant affects younger people more. And it's not the last variant either. That's the really scary part.
Well, and that's also what everyone asked for. We want in-person education.
Mm-hmm.
We want to go back to, you know, life. Everybody had their selfish moment here. And for better or worse, we're in different uncharted waters with this large health crisis that is ongoing. So, yeah, it's unfortunate that they're sick. And I'm just thankful that people around that government are still standing up for what they know is right for people's health.
See, I can't wrap my head around what makes somebody decide not to get the vaccine, especially, you know, I'm seeing reports of people who are in the ICU or have been there and are you know, in a hospital bed as they speak saying, no, I'm still not going to get the vaccine.
That's what I mean by denial.
You're in a damn hospital, for God's sake. Doesn't that convince you that this is serious? And what are you afraid of as far as the vaccine? That is going to, what, put you in the hospital? Come on. I mean, you seem to like it there, so if that's what you think is going to happen, maybe that's a plus. I don't get it, but what I really, you know, I can forgive it because people are misled all the time, and they have their superstitions, and they have their misinformation. What I cannot forgive are those people who know better, who lead them astray, and exactly... people like Governor Abbott and Governor DeSantis, there are people like that that have gotten vaccinated themselves but will not encourage other people to act responsibly and will basically ensure that the most irresponsible of all legislation comes to pass and under the guise of protecting privacy or whatever crap they're shoveling today. It's got nothing to do with that. And you know, it's basically... a political issue for them, because one side is saying one thing and being responsible, instead of joining them and saying the same responsible thing, they have to fight them. They have to make it a debating issue. And we're all paying for that. Whether we're vaccinated or not, we're all paying for that, because we have to walk around with masks again. You know, we have to worry about our friends and neighbors becoming susceptible. We have to worry about ourselves to a degree now as well, because we really should have licked this. It should have been done. And if people had gotten vaccinated in the numbers that we were hoping for, it would have been. It would have been. At least, you know, for a region, for a time, until the whole world was able to become vaccinated as well. right now, we're all so pessimistic because of these avoidable circumstances.
Surely, surely. And for those of them that survive, there will be plenty of time to go through their failings and shine plenty of light on it. So I think now is not, these people, their individual choices and whims are really not what we need to meet in the moment. Mm-hmm. I think it's more about reaching people who can be reached, working around some of the restrictions that crazily these leaders are putting into place, and caring for one another where there are gaps, and there are plenty of them, and a lot of it is due to this ignorance. But we could go on and on about this.
Yeah.
For
and we have like
DeSantis. I mean, Florida's insane right now, and I know people. I've had more closer connections. You know, I know we talked about this on the other show, and many people, this is hitting a little closer this time.
Mm-hmm.
It's wider spread. There may be people you're not aware of in your network that had their misgivings, or they have medical conditions. And, of course, you're not privy to everyone you know in your family or in your wider friend network, you know, what their exact medical situation is. Or maybe they're just part of this non-believer denial crowd. That has an impact.
Mm-hmm.
There may be, you know, people at your schools or in your community groups and places you frequent, more of them.
Mm-hmm.
And at younger ages, it just, how much more loss before we take it seriously? And I'm crushed at a lot of how it's gone. And I just think that we must keep information as factual and current and just try to carry on without, you know, their help, because we really could use all hands, you know.
Well, I think we need to be more aggressive. I think we have become more aggressive as far as raising our voices, making sure that the facts get out there, not just simply accepting it as, oh, well, that's your opinion and it's perfectly okay. No, it's not perfectly okay, because it's a health menace. It's getting worse. And it's going to be a catastrophe for so many that's completely avoidable if we simply tolerate your right to be irresponsible. If there were governors out there encouraging kids to take heroin, you know, just saying, hey, you know, it's your choice. It's, you know, do whatever you want. I think there'd be people outraged at that. And I dare say that's less dangerous. Because you know, a fatal disease that spreads is something that can get out of control a lot quicker. And if you don't choose the solution to that and encourage people that whatever they feel like doing is just fine and dandy, you might as well just be spreading it around yourself, just like Governor Abbott has done. And I just wish we had the same kind of judging that we would have for somebody who did something as irresponsible as encourage kids to, you know, take drugs or play in traffic or whatever. They are doing the same thing here and disguising it as some kind of political issue.
I don't want to be technical, but this is intramuscular.
Uh-huh.
And heroin use would be intravascular or intravenous.
Okay.
So,
well, that's your opinion.
Different type of,
I believe otherwise.
Injection, uh-huh. But sure. And, also, young people aren't eligible. You could take this if you're 16 plus. I think the rules are a little bit more relaxed with heroin, but technically this injection, as distinct and different as it is also not something anyone younger than 16 could access at this point. So
I see.
Just want to be clear.
Yeah, no, we have to be accurate.
In the sake of, you know, getting the public health information out there.
People, and please, take care of yourselves. And if you know somebody who's not, talk to them. You know, everyone has a power to get somebody to listen to them. So just because we're taken care of doesn't mean we can't help others. You might be able to reach the person that nobody else can.
And don't do heroin.
No.
It supports terrorism.
What I said was in any way implied. Nobody believes that. Nobody believes I was encouraging people to take heroin. Don't take heroin. Stupid idea. Okay, so we gotta get to the elephant, the big elephant, which is Afghanistan. Oh, my God. Well, okay, first of all, let's get it out right there. It's Biden is responsible. It's something he has to take the blame for. But if you end the sentence there and don't say anything else, you are being completely unfair, unfactual, living in another fantasy world. This is a failure not only of Biden, but of the entire American foreign policy system. And in this particular case, one that has spanned four presidents. I am sick of seeing people, pundits on TV, saying that Biden should have done this, should have done that, and completely skipping over Trump and Obama and Bush. You know, I saw one commentator on TV that was talking about the failures of Biden and Obama on this. That's completely leaving out Trump, completely leaving out the guy who started the whole thing, Bush. I mean, come on, let's be a little bit fair on this and spread the blame, because there's plenty to be spread. The whole idea of going into Afghanistan in the first place in 2001 was a bad idea. I know, I was one of the people saying that. There were a lot of people saying that. Everything these people have said has come to be true. Not seeing anybody saying, wow, you know what, we should listen to those guys next time. Because you won't. You never do. And time and time again, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq or you know, any other place that we decide we can make better by sending our troops, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. There are ways of making things better. And occupying a country and nation building, it's not one of them. And we're learning that horrible lesson of what happens if we just take these things for granted and assume that it's all going to work out. 20 years, our longest war ever. And it's really no different than when we started. What does that tell you about the whole idea of going in there in the first place?
It didn't. I think it didn't end up where we started. I think it's worse now.
Yeah,
in many ways.
That.
It's much worse and was made worse in large part. I mean, I don't want to, first of all, don't any individual soldier or fighter, all the way around, on all sides, of course, I'm sure is dedicated to their cause and I'm not speaking when I say they or the military. I don't mean individual fighters at all. I mean the mission itself, the leadership. And I think it changed the mission, as it were, transmuted across those presidencies into different things. But the dishonesty, I think, going in that it would solve something in a concrete way, the same fear of terror that got us into it becoming something that this kind of adventurism, military force, direct action would solve the fear of terrorism. We all talked about this at the turn of the millennia, this concept of terrorism was being used to open up a lot of authority to police, to things like the entities like Homeland Security. It made air travel unbearable. And those acts, the Freedom Act and the Patriot Act, those were all assembled after the terror attacks of 9/11. But the history really in fighting in Afghanistan was linking those attacks to terror networks, but this other sordid history that we had for a really, really long time. And it's laid bare. Like, everything that happened, there was this plainness to it. I mean, in the last couple weeks. Like, reports of different things happening, we weren't responding, because that was a change in tact there to allow things to go in a different direction. And I'm thankful that it's not continuing to be, that there aren't hawks coming out, and there probably will, but that this fear isn't perpetuated, that, just that it, even though that I said it is a worse situation, we're not so afraid of terrorism that we need to start all over again. I was, as I was seeing a lot of the changes this last weekend, I was thinking, oh, wow, something like that is actually possible in how precarious this is. But it's not. The administration has stuck with the direction that we've gone in. And what I'm alluding to a little bit is the February 29th meeting where the previous administration set this deadline. You're hearing a lot about that. Well, the interim administration the U.S. met with the Taliban in that meeting,
mm-hmm.
But the current president, the one who fled, he wasn't a part of that.
Yeah, that was interesting. That was the whole Trump negotiation, something Republicans are trying desperately to forget. He left out the Afghani government, not the Taliban. He left them out of the negotiations. I'm unclear as to why that was, but it seems like if they were a part of that, then maybe there would have been better communication. I'm also hearing this year that same Afghani government didn't want to talk to the Taliban, which seems kind of immature, since it's obvious that they're coming into power. You should try and work things out somehow, naive as it sounds. What choice do you have?
I think that's exactly where we're at. This is not a U.S. thing anymore, but as it appears, I think we need to have some self-awareness. The Afghan army is called the military that was built essentially after we propped up this leader Ashraf Ghani, and we armed this fighting force
uh-huh.
for the Afghan and made it much like our central force, and that's being discussed about now. So we sort of hamstrung them, we as in the previous administration, setting them up for this withdrawal, and that's kind of what Biden was referencing yesterday, is that 3 months into my presidency, we would have to be gone. And then he extended that kind of without consultation. So this was sort of the beginning of the disconnect between
right.
what was really happening, which was, you know, the last 2 years, area had been retaken and there were bombings and all kinds of things going on there. Nobody cared. Nobody was paying attention. And the appetite to continue to fund it and fight back was long gone.
Right.
And that's been talked about in the context of not having a lot of American casualties, even though the Afghan military, who was fighting as a against the Taliban, was taking on plenty of casualties. Here, we left them out of the meeting, went around them, talked directly to Taliban, mm-hmm. and set up this scenario, which is really bizarre considering we had funded and trained and wanted the success of the Afghan military, and that's where we're getting now this contradiction with Biden saying it's on them for fighting for their country and so on.
Yeah,
and so
that's not entirely fair, but we kind of set them up for failure, but at the same time, did Americans want this to continue for another decade? It's clearly an unsustainable situation, but it's also something that should not have hit anyone by surprise. Yeah, it was surprising how quickly the Taliban took over the country and made it into Kabul, but not too surprising. Not too surprising at all. It's a fact, and we need to adjust to those facts. It shouldn't be people. My God, people climbing onto airplanes. I mean, I cannot even imagine the thinking behind that. First of all, can you even survive clinging to an airplane flying through the air? I don't think you can.
No. All of that was incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, so, I mean, take your chances with the Taliban, because that's certain death. It's just...
I think it's not a very keen understanding of air flight.
Yeah, so, you know, at this point...
But the weirdest thing is those are the same people, the same country that was doing all the bombing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those were our airstrikes for many, many years, and yet these people want to cling to our plane. Like, there are so many paradoxical aspects to this, I think.
Well, I think they were on the side of the people fighting the Taliban, obviously.
Absolutely, but it's like not continuing something that should have never started in the first place. How noble is that?
But look,
not very.
I don't want to sound naive here, but is it possible the Taliban of 2021 is different than the Taliban of 2001?
I think that's the best scenario we can hope for.
I think we have no choice at this point but to consider that possibility. First of all, they look like the same guys. It's like, you know, they were in stasis for 20 years, and here they are away again. They look exactly the same, and the reason for that is they're not the same. These are the kids of the people that we cut off contact with in 2001, and they may be somewhat different. You know, I'm doubtful. I don't have a whole lot of faith in this, but you know, I'm seeing stories like this. This is on Vice today. Since the Taliban took control of Kabul on Sunday, the world has witnessed eerie and horrific scenes. We've all seen the scenes of people scrambling to secure passports and clinging to flying planes. But amid all that chaos and uncertainty, another set of videos shows members of the fundamentalist group engaging in almost childlike playfulness at local theme park rides and in a workout facility. There's a viral clip that's emerged of two men sharing a ride in a bumper car while holding on to what appear to be rifles, because they always have the rifles. And outside the ring, people are watching. Another video shows bearded men perched on small painted ponies on a merry-go-round. Not making this up. Another video showed armed men using the gym. In the recording, a man pedals backwards fiercely on an elliptical machine while another is seen holding what appears to be a rocket launcher. I mean, these are bizarre scenes, but they kind of give me hope that this kind of childlike wonder that they're experiencing, there might be some hope in that. And if they can be steered into a better direction than they have gone over the past few decades, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be the hell that we're all assuming it's going to be. I mean, it's not ideal for sure, but you know what else is not ideal? Saudi Arabia is not ideal. The crap that women have to go through in that country, they don't have the freedom to travel, they can't get a passport, they can't choose a marriage partner, they're victims of domestic violence, they get discriminated against with the employment of all sorts and health care, they can't get divorced if they need to do that, they never get custody of their kids if they are divorced by their husbands. There's all kinds of political repression and restrictions of one sort or another, and it's not the only country where that kind of thing happens. Not excusing anything that's happening in Afghanistan or anything that has happened there, but we're not fighting at all against what's happening in Saudi Arabia. Just a bunch of activists are, but certainly our government is not. So let's take a good hard look and say, can we make Afghanistan better, not by dropping bombs, not by invading, but by steering these people in a better direction. So far they're saying encouraging things. I mean, you know, I'm not thrilled with women having to wear veils. I'm not thrilled with a lot of the beliefs. But I knew I wasn't going to be thrilled with the overall status. But if people aren't being massacred, if people aren't living in actual terror, that's basically has evidence behind it of people being massacred and things like that. If that hasn't begun, maybe we can stop that from happening. What choice do we have at this point? We're not going back in. You know, we are obligated to get as many people out who want to go out, and I think that's the best thing we can be doing right now. I heard numbers like 30,000. That seems kind of small to me, but if people can be guaranteed the right to leave, if they want to leave, I think that's a great first step. And then let's work on it from there. Instead of not talking to these people, instead of considering them to be our permanent enemy, why not reach out and see if maybe there's room for dialogue? And this doesn't just go for, you know, for the Taliban. It goes for the Iranian leadership. It goes for Cuba. It goes for all kinds of places where we just don't talk, and we make no progress, and we just build up this hatred. This is an opportunity right now. This is a beginning. So let's see if we can be on the right side of this beginning and help keep it from turning into something really, really bad. I mean, the assumption, of course, is that it's going to be really, really bad, and maybe it will be. But if there's even a tiny chance that we can do something to prevent that, it's worth taking that chance. And I am sick of hearing Republicans basically laying it all on Biden and now taking the side of refugees when before they were the ones that made it incredibly difficult for people from Afghanistan to settle in this country. Lee Zeldin, for instance, you know, our esteemed representative, who is the mouthpiece of Trump, basically just coming short of calling on Biden to resign. Maybe he wants to run for president now, too. Who knows? But if an Afghan refugee moved onto Lee Zeldin's block, you can bet he'd be leading petitions to prevent that from happening. You can just bet. And yet, he's first in line to criticize that all these people are being left behind. Where were you over the last few years? This hypocrisy. The GOP has removed a page that was put up in 2020 in which it praised Donald Trump for signing a historic peace agreement with the Taliban. Yeah, this comes from The Guardian. They confirmed the webpage's removal after successfully tracking down the now-deleted page via the Wayback Machine. Yeah, our friends over at archive.org. Featured as part of a section titled President Trump is Bringing Peace in the Middle East, the page described how the former U.S. president had continued to take the lead in peace talks. The page also claims that while President Trump has championed peace, Joe Biden has taken the lead in pushing for endless wars. Kind of interesting in light of what's being talked about today. It's also notable that the now-deleted webpage claimed Trump had taken action to defeat ISIS and eliminate dangerous leaders. Abdul Ghani Baradar, the co-founder of the Taliban in Afghanistan and the organization's current political chief, was released from a Pakistani jail at the request of the U.S. while Trump was in office. Trump has been a vocal critic of President Biden's withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, branding it one of the greatest defeats in American history. It is time for Joe Biden to resign in disgrace for what he has allowed to happen in Afghanistan, Trump said in a statement. It shouldn't be a big deal because he wasn't elected legitimately in the first place. See, we're just going right back to that, making it into a political issue.
He thinks this could be a scandal and on a scale enough to do that.
The criticisms come despite the fact that it was the Trump administration was first brokered a deal to withdraw troops from the region. This is a Trump deal. In the now-deleted GOP webpage, it is stated that Trump negotiated a deal for the withdrawals by May 2021 in exchange for a Taliban agreement to not allow Afghanistan to be used for transnational terrorism. May 2021. Imagine if all this had happened months ago. And again, this should have been planned a lot better, and that's on Biden. No question about that. I don't see any Democrat denying that, saying that Biden does not hold responsibility for this. But I see plenty of Republicans saying that Trump and Bush have no responsibility for this whatsoever, which is a load of crap. We've heard the rest, but it's an ugly situation, and there are people making it worse. Now, the Taliban has announced a general amnesty for its citizens across Afghanistan, urged women to join their government today, seeking to convince a wary population that they have changed a day after the deadly chaos that gripped the main airport as desperate crowds tried to flee the country. But it's significant that the deadly chaos was not at the end of a gun held by the Taliban, not yet anyway. Like I said, this is a moment. This is an opportunity. And there may be a chance here. We should look at it. And we should also get everyone out of there who wants to go out. We have an obligation. You know, they're talking on Fox News. They're talking about, is it on us? Is it our responsibility to take in Afghan refugees? They actually have the audacity to ask this.
I'm so tired of stupid questions from cable TV.
But this is, I mean, they can't seem to make up their minds. Half of them are saying, how dare Biden abandon people like this? They look at them at the airport. And then the other half, or maybe the same people at a different time, are saying, oh my God, there's refugees coming to this country, terrorists and brown people, and we can't have that. It's not our fault. Pick a lane. Seriously, this is insane. You're just getting hatred from one side or another. Yes, we are responsible, and we need to do the right thing. Other countries do as well, but us mostly. No question about that. This shouldn't be a discussion.
I think the military is planning a couple different locations, enough for 20,000. I know Germany offered 1,000 immediately. Canada offered another 20,000 refugees. I think the American bases are specifically for SIV applicants and so forth, but it's ongoing. There is definitely planning and responsibility being taken, as there should be. And any kind of we need to be afraid of these people, that kind of crap, like, yeah, that's got to go. We're not hearing that. We know how, you know, we had the bravado in Bush. We tested out all the drones and invented MRAVs and all that under Obama and continued the belligerence with Trump. We're stopping.
Yeah.
It's over.
Yeah.
Gravy train has parked.
You want to take a good first positive step? Let's start welcoming these refugees to our towns, to our cities, now. No matter what side you're on, no matter what political side, that is the right thing to do. Disagree? Let us know. OTW at 2600.com. I'd love to see the logic. Okay, on to a feature now. That thing is so overheated. It's time for our feature films of the year that was. And I got to say, this is the feature where we watch Academy Award-winning films over the years. And we're up to, what year is it? 2003, okay. This we had to put in a lot of work for because it's not only a sequel, it's a double sequel. It's Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King.
It's based on a book.
Oh, I know that. It's based on three books. But the thing is, this is the third in the installment. And unlike last week's film, which was also a sequel, I didn't know it was a sequel after we had seen it. This one you kind of know is the third chapter. So you have to see the first two chapters if you want to have any sense as to what's going on. I mean, we didn't read the book. And, you know, I feel kind of bad that obviously by not reading the book, I'm not going to get as much out of it as people who did. The third and final chapter of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And I'll just say off the bat, a fantastic piece of work, absolutely incredible, amazing. If you're a fan of Tolkien, absolutely a pinnacle. That said, I've got questions, I've got notes, you know, I've got things that obviously somebody who is not completely into this world might say. So please forgive us if we say anything that is sacrilege to the Tolkien fanatics out there. It's an incredible piece of work. The incredible books, incredible fantasy land that has been drawn out, and I respect that immensely. And it was a good almost 12 hours of film watching that we had to do over the past couple of weeks. So a lot of work we put into this, and we were obliged because we have to see the Academy Award winning films. But again, to appreciate this, kind of had to see the first two.
Yeah, and there's so much in it as far as characters, as well as places and battles. And I found myself, specifically with battle scenes, reflecting on some of the other films we've seen.
So many battles.
That had a lot of that. I was seeing a lot of, like, the sort of Braveheart battles. But
yeah.
Because you have different clans, and of course with much more fantastic creatures.
Can I just ask, what is it with swords? I mean, swords kind of died out a while ago, yet we are still so fascinated with films that have to do with sword fights.
There's a lot of fetishizing of the swords.
I mean, I guess I should be glad it's not guns, but still.
Even, okay, specifically, since you bring that up, a magical sword breaks. while battling Sorin.
Always a magical sword.
And the broken part of the sword cuts off his finger, and plunk, plunk goes the ring. Then that ring is found, that is the whole
genesis. Can I just get into
that?
Yeah,
the thing.
The ring being lost and then found. As we saw in the flashback in the third film, a couple of hobbits are fishing, and one falls into the water and just happens to see this ring on the seabed or riverbed or whatever.
Smeagol and Deagle?
Whatever, yeah. And they grab it, or he grabs it. And it's even part of it is visible, sticking up from the ground. It's not like it's buried. So, okay, so the ring has been lost now for all this time because it fell in a body of water and nobody could find it. But as soon as a hobbit is holding it, all of a sudden everybody is going nuts because they're aware that the ring is somewhere or exists. I don't know. I just think, you know, it could have been hidden better. And I'm unclear as to what it is that makes it suddenly visible. Like all these fights that we saw, all this mayhem and chaos and slaughtering, which, you know, I didn't really think that was going to be happening with hobbits and all that. But that's because Frodo had the ring. It's a few steps to how Frodo got the ring. But because he has the ring in his hand or tied around his neck, is that why all these armies are invading various towns and villages across the realm?
Sorin's looking for the ring.
Yeah, but he wasn't looking very hard when they were going fishing, was he?
Well, it's the ring being active, I think, that attracts the eye of Sorin. And what has happened with both Smeagol, then he becomes Gollum because he kills his brother and then runs off and has his mind twisted up by
I think it's
being
his cousin. And he
ensnared.
He kills him and then becomes a creature called Gollum.
The ring captivates him, but then... Yeah. So, Froyo...
Frodo.
That was what you kept calling him. I was just trying
to correct you. I would never disrespect the trilogy by saying something like that.
All right.
But Kyle, yes, hang your head in shame.
So, his... Let's say disturbance by finding it, by maybe putting it on his finger. And it isn't actually him. It's Bilbo before
Frodo.
Yeah,
it's his uncle.
It's his uncle, yes, okay. And his uncle then gifts it to him or puts it in his charge reluctantly. But that draws the Eye of Sorin. So when it's messed with by a person or a hobbit and activated, I'm putting that in big quote, that, I think, is what causes the awareness and the tumult from Sorin's beasts flying around. Remember the ghostly, the death-type creatures with no face?
Yeah, there's a lot of those. A lot of creatures. Oh, my God, so many creatures. Okay, so basically activating the ring by putting it on your finger or whatever, it just seems to me, if this ring existed all this time, they would be turning over stones everywhere to find it. And just, you know, at the time of that battle, when his fingers got cut off thousands of years ago, and apparently, actually the guy who did that kept the ring. It fell into the river somehow. You'd think somebody would have been keeping track. I don't know. Okay, that's just a pet peeve of mine.
They kept the sword, too, and the sword was broken. And then later, actually in this film, the sword is reassembled.
Yes.
They and I think they should
forged from Valyrian steel or whatever.
Yeah, that's the wrong series.
But you know, there were so many similarities. There's Game of Thrones, you know.
At least they recast the sword in Game of Thrones. This they just like heat it up and bang it together. That to me is not a proper sword fix. But that's just me being a sword person.
Babylon 5 has rangers.
They
all have rangers that look the same and are doing basically the same thing, and they even have names that are so similar, Lorien and Zahadum, and it's...
Well, there's
you know,
a lot of referencing
it, it's kind of like religion, where there's all these different factions, but they're basically telling the same story. And I guess that's kind of neat. And also, Lord of the Rings itself, based on Beowulf, and going back centuries. Okay,
there's
great.
A lot of genre borrowing, and you saw that many-fold, you know, borrowing of... Dragons, who's borrowing what from where?
Well, okay.
I mean, the stories share that, and that's why I think where you're absolutely right. It's like it's a correlation of realms and kind of a religious thing, but it's this myth around these fantastic places.
On the subject, though, of creatures, we see the bad guys, and they always have these horrible creatures, like, you know, wolf-like creatures that ride like horses and dragons and these massive elephants. Oh, my God. God, these elephants, they're like 100 times bigger than an elephant. And first of all, what do they eat to stay alive? They have to decimate an entire county.
Just say orcs.
They're not orcs. They're elephants.
No, they eat orcs.
Oh, they just saying, I don't think that's enough for them.
Just say it's an orc.
And can you imagine when it comes out the other end what that does?
That it would crush people.
But all these creatures, are they only tameable by the bad guys? Why can't the good guys tame these creatures and use them? I don't get that.
Well, I think part of that you have to, and you see it as it's built up in the previous books, but basically the forest, the trees are being used to power this deep, dark sort of Bronze Age medieval thing where they're almost growing creatures in a futuristic way, but it's of course grimier and more like sorcery, where they're creating these kind of zombie beings and mm-hmm. megafauna that are also sort of possessed, which again in other stuff, you know, White Walkers, all that, I mean, there are things conjured up by the evil forces, I guess, that Sorin is imbuing into, and I forget the dark sort of wizard.
Just saying,
the
good guys could be a little more evil. They might win some more battles that way. And can I just say a couple things about Gandalf? Because, you know, Gandalf is one of the first characters we meet, you know, this wizard guy. Okay, so he's Gandalf the Grey, in the first film, Gandalf the Grey, and then he gets killed. I hope I'm not ruining it for anybody, but you know, I will ruin the whole thing if you keep listening. He gets killed, or he falls off a massive cliff after this crazy evil creature, which in the second film we find out that as he's falling, he starts another fight with this creature, also falling to his death. I don't understand the point of fighting a creature as you're both falling to your death, but whatever. Once the second film gets underway, he suddenly reappears as Gandalf the White. So he's basically change from gray to white. Other than that, what's the difference? In the film, you know, he's riding around on a horse. Yeah, it's a white horse. So he's got this white thing going on. But he's basically the same guy. He seems to have the same abilities and things like that. Is he dead or is he not dead? I don't understand why the transition. He didn't seem to gain any magical powers. If they did, it wasn't really represented in the film. I don't get why he waited so long to join the decisive battle in the second film, because had he been there on time, like everybody else, a lot of people wouldn't have died. You know, I don't have a lot of hostility for Gandalf, but I just don't understand where he's coming from, to be honest. So I just have a couple issues with him.
Certainly. No, I think he won, and maybe he absorbed the beast that he had defeated on his way dropping. You see them drop down and then through like a hole into a large cavern. They seem to fall forever or for like an infinite period, and I don't know what exactly they mean. I think the background of the book, this may be a distinction from the book and how this was adapted. There may be much more detail there. But I think that's throughout this film. There are questions like that about the story and how they, quickly went past certain parts. My other, question, and this is, I'm going to leave this open. Technically, is this a film, or did we watch an animation?
I think we saw a bit of both. There was definitely animation in there, you know, with the whole Gollum creature and all that. And certainly, they didn't really fight these battles with thousands of people.
There's a really interesting aspect to this with the amount of technology and what we've seen in Best Pictures as they've changed. In making historic epics, from like Ben-Hur and a lot of the early color motion picture, how it changed through Titanic, where they implemented a lot of computer graphic design and stuff. Here we see even more of that in a character that uses motion capture like Gollum. It was more computer animation, I would say. And I think this is really important, given all the superhero stuff we see now, many and a lot of the large effects and creatures themselves are computer-generated now, and this is, I think, a marking point of how to create these stories and how to integrate the technology.
I'm sorry, we've run out of time. As far as a massive film, a lot of effort on the part of a lot of people. One final question for me is, why are hobbit doors round? They're not round creatures. They're just short. They don't need the round doors. I don't get that. That's an architectural issue. Somebody knows, just write to us, otw@2600.com. Hey, a couple of things. We are still releasing Lost Audio every day. Today was kind of interesting. We released an old episode of a show I used to do called News of the World. That's where we would play news broadcasts that took place over shortwave in English from foreign countries. Thought this might be a little bit of interest. So listen to this excerpt here. This is from 1987.
The new partnership has been a reunion with constant bickering within the coalition. But Chancellor Kohl has made it clear that he wants it to continue, not least because the Liberals' presence helps him to keep the rightists in his own party in check.
That was taken from Radio Deutsche Welle, the voice of West Germany, this past Sunday. While the elections in West Germany comprised a major part of European news this week, there are always other ongoing topics. The subject of Afghanistan comes up frequently in the international community, and this next piece comes from Radio Moscow. Regrettably, we don't have the beginning, so we join this commentary in progress.
Was looked upon as the first step in drawing Kabul into Washington's orbit. But the Afghans decided differently, and their vote was overthrown by the revolution. It was then that the American government decided to use any means to return the old, convenient regime. Later, it became known that 1 month after the revolution in Afghanistan, Washington had decided to overthrow the new government.
Okay, we're just going to leave it there. But, yeah, 1987, of course, this was in the middle of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, which also ended in defeat. Interesting topics and conversations. If you want to hear the whole show, just go to our webpage, 2600.com. You'll see a link to Lost Audio, and just go to the Lost Audio for today, which I think is August 17th. August 17th. We've been releasing audio every day now for the past month. We have a couple of months left ahead of us. All sorts of memories from the past and fascinating things. We're just for a full archive of all sorts of fascinating material. Here is something interesting, too, from Afghan radio. This was recorded in 2009.
Live from Afghanistan.
Breakfast,
breakfast,
with Dave Simon.
BFBS Radio. Monday, October the 26th, 2009. Op Eric, Afghanistan. Now, BFBS Radio is here on the ground.
The great thing about having the BFBS Radio here in Afghanistan is that they're going to be dealing with a lot of the local issues. They're going to get up-to-date information. They're dealing with the guys on the ground as and when things happen. The news is going to be up-to-date. The issues are going to be up-to-date. The music's going to be up-to-date. We'll be able to request it when we want, and we'll be able to have feedback, which we don't have at the moment.
I think it'll bring a lot of morale, especially to our office.
It's great. It's full of troops, and it strengthens that bond when you're away from your family. It gives you that extra link back home.
Yeah, that's not really the sound of Afghanistan, is it? But that was the sound of occupation, 2009. We're going to go out with actual sounds of Afghanistan from 1979. I'm not entirely sure if this was before the Soviets invaded or afterwards, but it sounds a lot more authentic. And it's my hope that Afghanistan will go back to being a lot more authentic and a country where terror is not the rule. That's up to the world. That's up to all of us to put the pressure on the right places. Again, write to us, otw@2600.com. Stay tuned for Finn. We'll see you next week.
Have fun.
Thank you.
بخشاد افغانستان کابل ده بخشار اگر سبارون رو میکیگی
در غرمه 12 بجه رادیو افغانستان کابل.